introduce our main speaker for this evening, Larry T., from Bellflower, California.
Hi, everybody. My name is Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank this group for inviting me out to be here. And I want to thank the men that I sponsor and my grandbabies for driving out with me. There was about seven of us in this van. And I'm extremely glad to get out of that thing. Nothing like listening to Black Flag all the way up here, you know. And I didn't even know who the hell they were, you know what I mean? I do now, you know. And but really, I want to thank Travis for driving and all the guys coming out and making the ride with us. I want to thank Andreas? Right? Whatever. No, you did a great job. You did a fantastic job. And the hospitality here. My home group is the Big Book Group of Bellflower, California. And we do have cake. And, all the time. Oh, wait a minute.
Let me get this out of the way. No, never mind.
I'm glad to be here. If you're new, my sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for close to 34 years and not amount to a goddamn thing. So I don't know where you think you're going if you're new, but, you know, look at you now, you know. You've trashed your life just good enough to get to old A&A, you know what I mean? And there's no door number three. This is it. You have hit the bottom of the barrel. You've made it. And it's not a matter of getting here. That seems to be the problem. It's a matter of what are you going to do to stay here? It's not about finding God. It's about what you're going to do once you find Him. Everything is after the fact here. And I know what it's like to be new. I know what it's like to be sitting in this room, maybe for your fourth or fifth or sixth time, coming back to this darn meeting one more time, sitting around people who every one of them seems to be doing extremely better than you've ever dreamed of, you know. And you're shaking, you're alone, you could be hallucinating, you could be vibrating so bad. And then you see this jackass from Bellflower with a tie on telling you know that 30 days ago I was on the streets of Los Angeles. Now I'm the president of the Bank of America. Thank you. You know, and I'm going, you know. I know what that's like, man. I know what that's like to feel lost, alone, and afraid and thinking, nope, this ain't the answer either. I've spent my whole entire life looking for the answer. And there is nothing sadder or more afraid than to be an alcoholic of our type, sitting in the answer, looking for the answer. And it doesn't happen just if you're new. There's people with a handful of years doing the same thing right now. You've got a hideous malady called alcoholism. And that the worst place for an alcoholic to be is not drinking and not doing AA. You are in a most wicked spot. And nothing will ever get better. And you begin to live a life of delusion. The book talks about it. It talks about we live a life of delusion. And what you think you're doing for the answer is not the answer. I was so determined that when I got so tired of trying to get my life together. I got so tired of trying to get the things that would make me a normal guy like everybody else. I got so tired of trying to be that normal guy that it drove me absolutely nuts. Especially after I got all those things. Getting those things is not the answer to your malady. Having a job and having a girlfriend and having a hotel and having a car is not the answer to your malady. You don't have to come here to get that. That takes hard work and good fortune. We even have a tradition that warns us about money, property, and prestige will divert us from our primary purpose. And if it does it to a group, it'll just kill the individual. And it is the thing that drives most alcoholics away from AA once they get here. Now, why would that be? Because they got what they think they came for. And there's no further work necessary. And if you're new, you'll hear them all the time parading up here on birthday night when they do have a candle to blow out. Jesus, let it go for God's sakes, man, you know. And what it will sound like is that I've been so blessed. I've been so blessed since I've been sober. I've got this, and I've been blessed with a car, and I've been blessed with a degree, and I've been blessed with... And you'll hear them talk about their great blessings. And if you watch them long enough, you'll watch them begin to hang themselves with their great blessings because they become obsessed to take care of their blessings instead of the place that blessed them when no one else will. You are my greatest blessing. Without you, there is nothing in my life that matters. My primary purpose is to stay sober and carry that message. And if you're new, if you venture to open up that book, read the doctor's opinion. And in there, he talks about two things with equal force. He talks about the phenomenon of craving, and he talks about a psychic change. And baby, if you have one, you better have the other. Because there's no middle of the road answer. And that's where I died. I was determined to find a middle of the road answer. There's got to be a way for me to keep this in my life if it's the last thing that I do. I couldn't imagine life without it. And then there comes a point in time that our book talks about in the agnostics, where if and when you want to stop, you can't. And when you do stop, you always start again. If that be the case, baby, you have got a wicked malady on you that only a psychic change will be your only hope to life. And that's what this room is all about. Now, to the untrained eye, this does not look like a place for a psychic change to happen. This looks like a holding tank of the county jail on visiting day, you know what I mean? But I tell you, something happens here. Something happens in these rooms of misfits. Something happens, and it happens every time we get together. It happens every time that this meeting gets together. There's something happens here where it takes lost souls like me and you, and we finally identify with somebody for the first time in our life. Not somebody telling you what to do. Not somebody threatening you to do something. Somebody that says, I understand how you're feeling, and this is what we're going to do about it. And then you can watch these people do it week after week, day after day. They're examples of this way of life. They're no longer telling you what to do. They're showing you what to do, and you can come right along with them. You know? Now, I'm a loser. I'm a hostile loser. You know what I mean? And when you're a loser like me, when you're growing up through life, your family members and friends are always bringing you people to your side to compare you to. And say, you know, why don't you try to be like Bobby, for God's sakes, you know? You know, you guys are in the same grade. He seems to be doing well, you know. And I remember being a freshman in high school and got caught being drunk. It was an easy catch. You know, there he is under there. You know, and me and my dad are sitting in the principal's office, and my dad sees this picture of this star quarterback up on the wall, old number 7. And my dad says, "For God's sakes, Larry, why don't you try to be like Coy?" And I said, "All right, Dad, I'll give it a shot." And I went and tried to be like Coy. My sophomore year, I got caught being loaded on barbiturates and whiskey, and I stole the janitor's cart, and I drove it through the library doors, you know. I had to get that book back, I guess, you know. And so me and my dad and my probation officer are in the principal's office, and my probation officer sees this picture of the star quarterback, and He says, "For Christ's sakes, Thomas, why don't you try to be like Coy?" And I says, "All right, I'll give it a shot." My junior year, my big sister starts dating some goof, and she brings him over, and who is it? Well, it's old number 7 right there on my couch, you know. My mom comes running over, and "Why don't you try to be like Coy, you son of a bit?" You know, I said, "All right, Mama, I'll give it a shot." My senior year, I'm in the Torrance jail getting ready to do 90 days. And somebody slides the newspaper under there, and it says that Coy makes all pro CIF. And I said, "My God, I'd like to be like Coy." You know, this cat's just clicking right along, you know. Well, lo and behold, I'm about 5 years sober in old A&A town. And my first sponsor, Don, and his buddies are telling me that old AA, what goes around comes around. That'll give you hope, you know. And Jesus, are you sure? You know. And in Los Angeles, it's vogue, and it always has been for years. On every street corner, they got these guys selling oranges or peanuts, or they have this sign that says, "I'll work for food." You know, like you don't. You know. And maybe you don't. I don't know, you know. And I look like a guy that needs help. People are always giving me little pamphlets telling me that Jesus and Jehovah and all these J guys are coming to town and I need to talk to them, you know. And I'm at the stoplight and I'm in my plumbing van and I've got my cardboard rolled up because at 5 years sober, things are going good in my life, you know. And I'm sitting in my little plumbing van and this guy with the sign is standing there and he locks eyes with me. And he starts coming over to my van, and he sticks his head in my van and goes, "Larry, Larry Thomas." And I go, "Coy." You know, it's old number 7 right there on the street corner, man. And I thought, my God, you know, I thought this guy had it made, which has been my problem my entire life, you know. And then it dawned on me that if there was any justice at an Alcoholics Anonymous, that maybe Travis or Mike or Larry can write this guy a letter saying, "Why can't you be like Larry?" You know what I mean? But that's been the story of my life, is that I've always felt like, and you know what? It took me years in Alcoholics Anonymous, identifying with you guys in here, to find out what a loser means. A loser is just Greek for quitter. Oh. Now, baby, if there's one thing alkies know how to do, we can quit. I've quit everything my entire life. I'm not a dreamer. I'm not a dreamer. I think of things that I would like to do. I think of, you know, God, I'd like to be a TV cameraman or, you know. But I tell you, man, when you're a quitter, you talk yourself out of that nonsense in about 10 seconds. Oh, man, no. Here's the kind of help I give myself. There's nothing like me, you know, being alone with me. I mean, you know, you want to talk about give the guy a gun? Just, you know, it's just me on me action for about 2 days, man. I'm ready to jump off the box, you know, because I eventually turn, no matter what good it is going on in my life, I turn it into crap. You know, no, you ain't got what it takes. You're never going to make it. You're never going to make it. And you wind up quitting stuff long before you even started. And what's the use? What's the use, man? Now, I wasn't brought up that way. I was brought up by decent people. My upbringing and my parents, if love was the answer to alcoholism, I was surrounded by it. I didn't know it. I didn't realize it until I had a child. I didn't realize it till I got a sponsor. I didn't realize it till I met people in Alcoholics Anonymous what love was. See, my whole entire life, love was a handout. Everything's been a handout in my life. I was born in Detroit, come out to California when I was about 4 years old, brought up in a little foster home and an orphanage for a little while in Gardena. Love that song. And it ain't going to happen. And my mom and dad got together, and they finally got me out of there. And my mom, she's a sweet lady today. She's a little Scandinavian lady. And growing up, my mom loved diet pills. So, yeah, she was always eating that speed and running around the house making Afghans, you know. And Everything in the house had fresh afghans. Every week it was different colors and shit, you know. Couches had afghans, your chairs had afghans, my dad's golf clubs had little poodle heads she knit, you know. And if we had any animals, they had a fresh vest on, you know. And no matter what time you got up, she was up, you know. She's cleaning stuff with toothbrushes and, you know, out in the garage sorting out nuts and bolts all night, you know, and grabbing the neighbor's, you know, power edger and just doing the whole block. And, you know, and burning food all the time. Everything's smoking up in the kitchen, you know, and... And I always got up early, you know, and she'd give me this burnt toast, you know, and I'd look at this black toast, and I'd look at her, you know, and she said, "Don't you give me that look." She says, "That burnt food is good for your gums, you know." Now, this lady don't have a tooth in her head, you know what I mean? That tells you, good for your gums, you know what I mean? She was my first tweaker I ever met, you know what I mean? But gave me a reference point, you know what I mean? And as some of you know, like this crowd here, that when you eat a lot of speed, you have a lot of hobbies, right? You bet! You know, and one of her hobbies that she was locked in on was that she loved to eat that speed and make these huge jigsaw puzzles, right? Not the 3,000 piecers, right? The 3 million piecers, you know, of the Mojave Desert, you know. And this would excite her, you know. She'd get all excited, you know, and she'd head off to Savon's and get her a carton of Raleigh cigarettes, you know, cash in her prescription, get that stinky peroxide that she'd put on her head, you know. And these cigarettes, these Raleigh cigarettes, on each pack of cigarettes, there was a coupon on the back. And she used to save those coupons to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in, man. And she'd come home with that stinky peroxide and eat those Dexies, you know, and wedge herself in that little breakfast nook, you know, and start making these puzzles, you know. And if she got a piece that didn't fit, well, she had a big pair of toenail clippers, she'd snip that son of a bitch down and wedge it in there, you know. And I loved my mom to death, man. I did. I would get up with her, and I would take stuff. You know, I was curious long before I was a drunk. And I tell you what, I love that lady to death, and I love her even more now. You know, she's 85, 86 now, and I have to introduce myself to her. But I don't mind it. I don't mind it. I don't mind walking the lady out that walked me in. And I don't do it to be a service. I don't do it to work a step. I do it because I'm her son and I love her. Just love the death out of her. You know? I don't ever want to forget what it's like to be 17 or 18 years old and be put away for a small period of time. And when you come out, you're supposed to show up at a place or at the house and you get off the bus. I don't ever want to forget that. I didn't come home on that Monday. I've been put away for about 6 months and I didn't come home. I showed up 5 days later, and where at? I showed up at a dry cleaner's in a parking lot where she worked. She's working in a dry cleaner's, and she's cleaning people's houses, and I'm ashamed of her. But I'm not too ashamed to show up unannounced on a rainy morning, 9 o'clock in the morning, and I'm about from here to that wall, and she's in there, and I'm hiding behind a parked car with that rain hitting me, and I got my drunken mud on and my filth. And I'm hiding behind a car waiting for that last customer to leave so I can make my move on her. And I remember I can hear it like it happened just an hour ago, me walking through that rain. And I go into that lady's place of business and startle her with my presence, which would be an ongoing thing in that young lady's life. And without skipping a beat, she opens up her Woolworth wallet and a picture of me falls out when I'm 8 years old, you know, on a Little League team. And that would be the only decent picture that young lady would have of me until I meet you guys. And without skipping a beat, she peels off $1 and $2. And I remember grabbing that money, just snatching it out of her little hands and running down to Wilmington and San Pedro where I'm going to die. Now, the thing that brings it home to me tonight in San Diego is you take that same man with his so-called desperation and hopelessness and stick me in a meeting exactly like this of Alcoholics Anonymous. And with my so-called desperation and willing to go to any length, I need to ask you new guys something. How come when my life depends on it, if you were to put the secretary of that meeting that same distance as me and my mom in that parking lot, how come if you were to put that secretary that same distance, I can't walk that distance and ask a man for a job in a meeting that's going to save my life, but I can walk that distance and use my mom and folks like her time and time and time again. And I'm here to share with you, if you're new, that if my alcoholism doesn't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will, make no mistake about that. Which is not why it's necessary for a man with close to 34 years to have a home group and a series of meetings in that week and a job in every one of them. And it's not so I can run off to San Diego and tell you about it. Well, maybe. No, not at all. Not at all. It's for one reason and one reason only. And that is that I will never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. But I can get so drunk that I can't make it back. And I never want to forget what that used to be like. I never want to forget what it was like to be going to all these meetings in Southern California and peering through your windows and looking at groups like this and wondering if I'll ever be in the middle of this thing called life because I knew you had something here. I wasn't ignorant. I wasn't in a blackout. You can't deny your eyes. And I knew I would never be able to sit in these rooms with you because there was just something too dirty about me. There was something too crazy about me. I don't see how you can just sit still for an hour without biting somebody or stanking somebody. You know what I mean? How do you do that? How do you talk to people for 10 minutes at a time? I see you guys talking to each other for over 5 minutes and I'm going, for God's sakes, what can they be talking about? You know? I don't know how to do that. I don't have communication skills or anything like that. I don't know if I'll be able to do it. I understand what that's like. And if I can get together with this group and give myself... We give ourselves completely to this simple program. Not just the things that are comfortable. We give ourselves completely to this simple program. Great events will come. Something will happen to you here. Dr. Bob talks about that if we put half the effort into getting sober as we did getting drunk, we'll have a shot at half the effort. Shit, I'm all for half. Sign me up for half, man. You know what I mean? But if I can get together with a sponsor in a home group and find that thing that keeps me from serving you, I will have found the key to life. There's a miracle here. There's a miracle here. And the moment I started serving the thing that I wanted so much from, I couldn't keep it from bleeding in every area of my life. See, that's exactly what we do here. We take what we learn here out there. And I guarantee you, what I'm like when I'm away from you has everything to do with what type of AA member I am without you watching. What I'm like at work, at home, and play has everything to do with what type of AA member you are. That's where we do it. They don't give chips for digging a ditch out there. They just want you to dig the ditch. They don't give chips for showing up on time with the paycheck and not bouncing the kids off the wall and cussing at them. See, that's how we take... Alcoholics Anonymous is a way of life. When practiced as a way of life, will relieve this obsession to drink. When I think of sobriety today, the thought of drinking and doing dope doesn't enter my mind. When I think of sobriety, I think about the way I live. And the way I live was taught by you. You people insisted that I behaved a certain way. And thank God for that. And then you showed me. Now, my dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy, singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. Man, he loved to get drunk and sneak into his own damn house. It was an amazing thing, you know. Yeah, he was a window-climbing alky, you know. Which I believe is a lost art in Alcoholics Anonymous. That old guy standing on that damn gas meter, pounding on that window, hoping that it's his own home, you know. getting ready to make the big dive over the sink, you know. He was a refinery worker. He was always, you know, he had these big boots, and he was always coming into the house on different hours, you know. And he snuck into my room one night. I could tell because his boot was on my chest, you know, and he had that boot on my chest. And I remember grabbing that boot and said, "Dad, you know, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys, you know? She's up anyway. I can, you know, I can hear the old Hoover going now, you know." And my dad was just a World War II vet, hard-working guy, you know. He used to tell me, "You don't know how good you got it. Back when I was your age, we really had it tough." And he was absolutely right. He lived in a tough time. He didn't have a ton of money. His father died when he was 13, choked on his tongue. His mother hung herself in Detroit jail. She was a drunken whore, and he had a dream, and that dream was to go into the Navy when he was 17 years old and marry my mom. Get her out of the convent, you know. And he wanted a clean one, you know. And they had a dream, and that was to come out to California and live the good life and live a life so well that their children would never have to want for anything. What is that but love? Where their children would not have to want for anything. All they wanted us to do was be happy and live the good life. That's all they wanted. And all I did was complain because they was never around. I introduced my mother and father into a level of living they didn't know existed. And then I rubbed their nose in it. And my book finally introduced me to a page that says, "We take the word blame out of our vocabulary, and where do you stand?" I had them all wrong. I had them all wrong. At 11 years old, I'm feeling lost and afraid in my own home. I'm hearing things in that house that I wished I didn't hear. I'm seeing things happen in that house that I didn't want to see. My parents fell off their pedestal in my eyes, and they become human beings, but I couldn't handle that. I didn't know what to do with that. At 11 years old, I started running away from home. I felt more a part of life underneath the street light under midnight than I did at my own dinner table. I couldn't stand to be in that house. I was always restless and irritable and discontented. I knew I wasn't going to amount for nothing, and I had so many questions at 11 years old, and I didn't have anybody to trust in my head. I wanted to go to them and talk to them about things. I wanted to go to the old man and ask him things, but I knew I couldn't because I knew he'd get mad at me because I didn't have the answer. I knew how he was. If I spilt the milk, I would get the belt. He'd always take me behind. There was always be something going on in there. And I didn't know what to do, but 11 years old, there was four of us, and we went across the street, and I drank a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, it didn't make a winner out of a loser, but it made being a loser okay. It was all right. It evened out the playing field, man. I'm all right right here. And I remember I've never laughed so hard in my entire life as I did that day. I never threw up so much as I did that day, you know. But I remember in the evening I kissed my first Latin woman. Yeah, it was my aunt. Went after her. That made my uncle a little leery, you know. Where is he? You know. I counted it. And I didn't head out to Skid Row the next day and lose my paper out and go to the treatment center and come to AA, you know what I mean? But I marked that spot. I marked that spot because it would be the only place that would even out the playing field, that I had a fighting chance for at least a couple hours to fit in somewhere. I've been fighting to fit in my entire life. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 30 years old and up to here with pep talks that were coming from me. "Come on, you can do this." You know, just out of stuff to do, man. But the older I got, the more I leaned on it. And I wasn't hitting it every day from them, but I marked that spot, you know. And the older I got, the more I leaned on it. And by the time I got to be a freshman in high school, kids were going to their lockers to get their books, and I'm going to my lockers to take a shot of Thunderbird and take some barbiturates to take away the shakes. I'm a freshman in high school. I started dating this little Mexican girl. She had some brothers. They liked cars, and I liked cars. I love cars to this day. And we didn't have four-wheel Jeeps up to here and bounce over to the mountains and stuff. I had a 62 Chevy drop right down to the damn ground, man. You could put a pack of Marlboro cigarettes right under that thing, man. I had a 62 Chevy Impala drive right to the ground. I had my hair all big and slicked back. I had white T-shirt and black khaki pants, and I'd drive around listening to the, you know, drinking that Thunderbird, listening to the Four Tops and the Temptations and Marvin Gaye and Smokey Robinson, and God, I loved it, man. You know, there was no black flag shit, you know what I mean? they start playing that, I'd rob them of their dope, you know what I mean? And man, I was in my plumbing truck the other day, and the Four Tops came on. I just start sinking in my damn car, man. I had my hair all big and white T-shirt, black khaki pants that came up to here, you know. My girlfriend Loopy, she used to curl her hair with soup cans, and the noodles were stuck in there, you know. And her sisters were telling me that men who are well endowed had big feet, so I had a pair of 15-inch shoes I was driving around in, you know. And I had my big hair and my big feet and Jesus, you know. Larry tripped over my foot tonight and I felt proud. You know. Want me to move that thing? Let me take off my shoe, big fella. You know. I loved it, man. I loved it. One day, me and I ran into a guy like that not too long ago, man. About 8 years ago, I'm up at the Glendale Mall, and this kid comes walking by, and he's a bad kid. You can tell. He's got his mom's earrings on, you know. That's a bad sign right there. Duck! You know, and he was so bad. He was so, so bad that he had his earlobes pierced. He had them drilled out. The son of a bitch had his earlobes drilled out. Where you could put an AA triangle in there, or a clock, or a set of spinners, you know. But if that guy ever comes to AA, it's every sponsor's dream. Because you tell old Raul to take a certain step, and he says, I ain't going to do it. Well, you can just grab him by the ears. Bring him right back in here, man. And this guy had his head all pierced. He had ball bearings all over his forehead, one in his nose up here in his eye, and one in his ear, one in his tongue. Had a chain wrapped around his neck, and that's hooked to his wallet. And I walked by him. He goes, well, what are you looking at? I said, I have a damn clue what I'm looking at, you know. I wanted to squirt him with some WD-40 to make sure he keeps moving on, you know. But lo and behold, we just started talking, and then we started laughing, and now I sponsor him. The guy lived down in Chula Vista, no doubt, right? He was a sailor, and he refused to work. Huh, that's new. Yeah. But he could hold a sign like a son of a bitch. You know, And I told him, I said, Ronnie, you know, and he used to call me, you know, when they're new, they're just right on the clock, man. He used to call me, Sponce, what do you want me to do? And I said, well, Ronnie, I said, why don't you unlock yourself, for God's sake, you know? Well, I go to these meetings and I feel so different, really. Maybe you're the only one wrapped up in a chain link fence, Ronnie. How about that, you know? But you know, whenever you start sponsoring these guys, they usually have your particular defects of character times 10, right? Now, like I told you before, you know, I was born with a 5-inch belt of lazy ass wrapped around here where, you know, the only thing that I thought about when I woke up was, when's my nap? You know, and Ronnie had a 10-inch belt of laziness wrapped around him, you know, and here he is, you know, and I said, Ron, if I'm going to sponsor you, you got to go to work. We're self-supporting here, you know, through our own contributions. And if you're new, that means you put a buck in the basket. I know if you're new, you think you can't afford it. However, I've noticed you got a $200 vape pipe. So maybe you could squeeze out a clam or two, huh, you know? $50 hat that you're wearing on backwards, you know what I mean? And I said, if I'm going to sponsor you, Hotshot, you better get a job. And he, you know, I didn't hear from him. A couple of days go by, and then a week, and then he calls me up, and he's excited. And you know, when these new guys are excited, you can almost see their tail wagging. Yeah. You know, spons. He says, I got a job. And I says, that's great, Ronnie. What are you doing? He says, well, a couple times a week, I'm going to go to a sperm bank. Now, I got a busy head. You know, I could see things happening, you know, and I could just see this cat getting ready for work every morning. Wrapping up that lunch, getting the thermos ready, throwing the old gloves in the lunchbox, you know. Grabbing that Hustler magazine and heading out the door to that hands-on job, you know. He's doing good now. And so I ran around with these guys for a long time, man, and everything that I was putting in my system was working. Every ounce of Thunderbird, every ounce of 151. And I loved it. And I knew me and Pooch and Loopy were going to bounce off into the sunset forever. And what had happened to me in 1969 is everybody was going places. Some folks were going to Vietnam, and I thought, well, maybe I'll grab my buddy and head out to Detroit and find my roots. And I wound up in Phoenix. And I'm off of North Central and Roosevelt at the Apache Hotel. And the Apache was $30 a month at the time. And all you had was a little window about this size that you could look out of and drink and dream and die. And know one of these days it ain't going to be like this. One of these days I'm going to have something, I'm going to be something, I'm going to go somewhere. But you see, I can't leave my room because I'm afraid. I can't stay in my room because I'm terrorized and I don't know where to go. I hook up with this plumber, and I've started working for this guy, and I find out that he's younger than me, and I ain't working for a kid because I got my pride. So I did what any honorable man would do. I faked a knee injury. I went down to the county hospital, and the doctor wrote me a prescription for Percodan. And then he left me a cardboard box full of prescription pads that he wanted me to have. Running down North Central, and I ducked into the wagon wheel bar, and I meet this guy named Ernie, and Ernie looks at these prescription pads, and we start writing prescriptions. We called up a guy in Yuma and Tempe and Nogales, and we start writing prescriptions for Secanol and Tuanol and Nembutal, and you name it all. We wrote it all, you know. And damn near took it all, too, you know. And after 9 months, they caught up with me. And when you're loaded on whiskey and barbiturates, there's no freeway chase on Channel 5 going on. There he goes down the 10 freeway. Look at him go. None of that was happening. I was going 9 miles an hour. And the cop was on foot, right? He was just... And I'm in my car, and I'm going, my God, could this cat run, you know? And threw me out of the car. They sent me up to Southern Arizona for about a year. I got out of there. They put me on a Continental Trailway, sent me back to California. In 1974, for the first time in my life, my probation officer put me on Anabuse. And for the first time in my life, I don't have a thing in my system since I was 13. I'm on this Anabuse. I'm on there for about 2 months. He gives me a voucher to go for a job interview. I take a bus to a job interview, and I'm 2 hours early. I'm pacing the... I wander into a Little League diamond. I'm pacing the Little League field. I don't know what to do with myself. I go into a Little League dugout. I start crying, and then I start laughing, and I get hysterical. This paranoia comes over me, and it locks. These hallucination comes, and they lock. I become somewhat catatonic. Some guy across the street sees me milling around, and he calls the paramedics. They come over there, and they take me, and they take me to the Harbor General Hospital in 1974. I've got a leg and an arm strapped down on a gurney. They're looking through my jacket, and they seem to think that because of the way that I've been living and the things in my life, that maybe I need to go to a state hospital out by Oxnard and be observed for 30 or 60 days. They threw me in a white van, chained my arm and my leg down on that van, head me out to Oxnard, California, where I'm going to be observe for 30 or 60 days. And a year later, they let me out. Totally observed, you know. Well, we couldn't find a damn thing in that man's head, you know. And they gave me some medications to take away for these certain things. But there's one thing that you can't medicate away in the mind and the body of an alcoholic. And that is this thought that only strikes us when we're sober. That no matter how nasty that last drunk is, that no matter what's going on with you physically, no matter what's going on with you mentally, no matter how much remorse you have, no matter how many pictures of people you've harmed and hurt, the only thing that not drinking has ever squeezed out of me is this time it's going to be different. I've got to find a way to keep that in my life if it's the last thing that I do. And it doesn't come to me in those words. It comes to me in words that me and you understand, like, screw it. What's the use? I grew up my entire life, like a lot of us tried to do, in that delusion, trying to incorporate a thought that normal people have into an alcoholic mind. And I tried to incorporate that lie in my life time and time and time again. And that lie is simply this, and you guys all know it. If you stop drinking, everything will be all right. And me and you stop drinking, and we're not all right. And the longer we stay sober, the worse we feel. And running down to that old club, seeing this clown from Bellflower, only makes you feel so damn different that you don't think you belong here either. We don't drink because we have reasons. We don't go ahead and drink because of where we live. We drink because we're powerless not to. You can't keep yourself from drinking. You don't have that kind of power. And if you did, we'd be meeting at your house tonight. We lack the power, and this is where we get the power. All I know is that I got out of there. They sent me to that nut house, and I ran out of Thorazine. In 1975, I came out of the county jail after doing a year, and they're sentencing me to 2.5 years in the state penitentiary. I'll wrap this up as soon as I can, young man. And I'm sitting in a holding tank about this size. In 1975, I'm in a holding tank about this size. And I came in with about 40 guys on the chain. And all through the day, one by one, these guys are leaving. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm the only one left. And a Scottish man with a patch rolled in there and he says, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He said, "Come with me, son. You're going to AA." And I thought, my God, what's AA? You know? Yeah, I mean, I've heard of OR and PO, but, you know, what's AA? And who's this Scottish pirate all of a sudden? You know, "Aye, lad," you know? Looking back well over close to 40 years, I know exactly what he is. Our book calls him a trusted servant. And what made that trusted man a trusted servant was simply this. He had no business being there. He wasn't on a panel. He wasn't part of H&I. He wasn't a counselor. He wasn't a probation officer. He was a refinery worker who just got the worst news of his life. And that is his wife was dying of a terminal disease immediately. And he knew she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. But somewhere in his book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the thought came to his head by sitting in a home group with folks like you. The thought came to his head. Practical experience tells us that nothing will ensure immunity from drinking than intensive work with other alcoholics. This works. And that man turned his car around and went to the South Bay Courthouse, talked to Judge Foy and Judge Hollingsworth, and they said, "We got a guy for you." And a man in 1975 took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of AA. Worst years of my life. But something happened to me on May 2nd, 1982. I knew that I'd always live like this. I knew that I'd always wind up drunk. I became hopeless and I was scared to death that I was going to drink again. A fear that I'd never had before because I didn't want to do it no more. And I knew I couldn't keep myself from doing it. But I did what I'd been told to do for the first time in my life. I did something I'd never done before. I gave myself completely to something. I'm going to let this guy have me, and I let my sponsor have me. Now, on May 2nd, 1982, I came to you and I had no faith. I had no God. I had no conception of spirituality. How do you find a God when you know there isn't one? The more I served you, the clearer he became. And the more I serve me, the darker I become. There's a miracle here. I come to believe in the enthusiasm of Alcoholics Anonymous. Enthusiasm is contagious. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, you never have to wonder where God is. On a Saturday night in San Diego, there's row after row after row of people who should be locked up dead or insane. And look at us tonight. We're happy, we're joyous, and we're free. You never have to wonder where he's at. Just come back and play in the evidence. Good night.